Okay, welcome to the, what are we calling this again? The Doctor Who discussion group, I guess, is really what we are. We have made, my mom made my brother come over to talk with us because he has opinions on it that are actually pretty good. Like, for instance, what happens when the Silence die? What was your opinion on that, Ryan? When the Silence die?
Yeah. Well, just that after, you know, they had everyone kill them, I mean, let me face it, they have all of New York and the planet covered in dead silence now, rotting. So every time someone looks away, they're like, what's that smell? Look down, scream, look up, forget about it. Yeah. That's got to, like I said, it's got to be a health hazard.
It's got to be a health hazard. Who knows what kind of disease the stinking, rotting corpses of these silence would have. Don't know. So maybe they find some other broadcast to invade and say, we've got to clean up New York City or whatever. Yeah. So that's kind of funny. So so Ryan is joining us, and my mother, Roxanne, and me, Lauren, and we are going to talk about the Doctor's wife. We decided just to spend the whole X amount of time, no really time constraints, talking about this episode that was written by Neil Gaiman, because it was a really, really cool kind of standalone-y episode. So, who wants to start us off? What did you like about this episode, Mom?
Oh, I don't know.
What, the Doctor's wife?
Yeah, the Doctor's wife.
That was interesting. It's, once again, he finds out that, well, up to this point, they found Daleks and Davros everywhere after the Time War. Even the Emperor survived in some wacky little pocket, recreating the race. Davros recreated an entire Dalek species from his toenail clippings. And yet they never really talk about, he's always been convinced that all of the Gallifreyans are dead because he'd feel it in his heart of hearts, one of them at least. And yet this is the first episode that mentions that if they were in a pocket dimension, then he wouldn't obviously be able to sense them. Of course, he gets there and he finds out they're borrowed, you know, attached to other
and
people.
I always thought if the Daleks could have been put in one of those little prison ships and blasted into the vortex, why couldn't some of the Time Lords use that as an escape pod and blast themselves into the vortex?
Because
he wouldn't know about them either, because he didn't know the Daleks were in that ship. He didn't even know what it was.
It's because, what was it, Timothy Dalton was too busy being an ironic Bond villain as Rassilon and just vaporizing people with his electro gauntlet.
Well, that was later.
He wasn't putting them in a prison and launching them into space.
Yeah, but I would have got in one of those things and saved myself. Heck with everybody else.
It does tick me off because since Moffat took over, he has slowly been weaning people away from the Russell T. Davies method. Remember how Amy was supposedly infatuated with the Doctor and then suddenly she wasn't? That was him starting the audience off with something they were familiar with, that every companion has to be in love with the Doctor, and then suddenly she wasn't.
But they still have very close ties because Rory is still jealous.
Yes. But there was also another one of his major changes, which is that Earth has lost the masquerade. We now know about Daleks and Cybermen and everything else, but suddenly we don't. We don't know if that's still stuck or not, because that was the cracks in the wall and all that junk.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if they
and
still
And then rebooting the universe.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another thing that he potentially has gotten us away from with his new series. And yet, the one thing he hasn't gotten rid of yet has been the fact that the Gallifreyans are evil and they're gone now, so he can still be his lonely little hermit.
Right, when you put it that way, too, the fact that he rebooted the universe was a really kind of good idea for a writer, because then anything that previous writers had done or previous stories had done, you can kind of reboot, really, and do what you want to do, which is very DC Comics right now,
yeah.
and the way they did their reboot. So he can go and get away from the of Russell T. Davies believing that, of course, the companion's going to be in love with the
Well, Donna
doctor.
Wasn't. I like Donna because she wasn't in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
She stood up to him and she wouldn't take any crap.
Yeah, yeah. Which is the kind of girl you should marry.
The
one who doesn't put up with your shit.
He was still very much aware
of
that. Remember when she was going to go for a moment and he was all weeping, goes, well, they all leave me after a while, but you've had your fun, and she says, I'm going to the loo, or something like that. And he's like, no. He had several moments with that.
Yes.
I think the specific one was when, did she meet her family again when the cars were farting helium and going to kill the planet because the Sontarans were converting the Earth, or some really strange junk like that.
So in this,
well, he always wondered why she wasn't in love with him. Why, you know, it was it was like the David Tennant. His doctor had this ego, and he expected them all to fall in love with him. Yeah. And she
didn't. I don't
want to
use the Q word and you know,
right,
connection with this, but he was a bit of a drama queen. I just like that he was the first doctor who regenerated and tried to take his TARDIS with him because everything was exploding.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't want to leave. You're going with me, bitch.
And
then this is the doctor's wife, the first moment she gets to say, why did you try to kill me? And she doesn't.
Right. And why did they call this episode The Doctor's Wife? That was kind of interesting. I don't know if that was something that Neil Gaiman did or something that Moffat let him do, because he did have to rewrite this a bunch of times. Like, I follow Neil Gaiman on Twitter, and he was really frustrated the whole process. He was, like, really happy to be writing for Doctor Who. He's like, don't get me wrong, I love this, this is awesome, but oh my god, if I have to rewrite this thing one more time, I'm gonna scream. So, yeah, and I think most of it was because he's more of a long game kind of writer. He had to pare a lot of stuff down and cut a lot of things that he thought would have been really cool to keep in.
Is that a hint there of what happened to the mythical Stephen Fry episode?
Yeah, that sort of disappeared. I think they called it The Doctor's Wife because they were giving us a sort of a bait and switch.
Right.
They were.
There's a way to draw in viewers.
Yes.
Another thing in this that seems kind of... one of the plot devices, the little box that he gets that has a message...
Yes.
What can we do? We'll start selling these to Doctor Who fans, and they do. I saw them at Dragon Con. They had them at the Forbidden Planet in London. I don't think they had them at the one in Cardiff, but the one in Cardiff was filled with Twilight posters, so there you go.
I still think you're missing the obvious here, which is that the TARDIS is his wife.
Yes.
Because
she's his
most loyal companion.
Right, and his longest companion.
There's one thing, though. He never knows where the hell he's going. She always takes him to his latest adventure. There you go.
He never knows where he's going, but she knows where he needs to be.
Right. She always she doesn't, you know, take him where he wanted to go, but she took him where he needed to be.
Well, I have to be surrounded by women when I say this.
Yeah, well, also, Ryan, to be fair to us, we weren't missing the point. We just hadn't gotten to it yet.
Yeah. Well, it's so ironic because the doctor was always referring to the TARDIS as she.
Right.
And I know it's tradition to refer to ships
as a
female.
A cruel mistress.
But,
yes,
but the doctor had always called the TARDIS she. He never said it.
Mm-hmm.
He said she. And when she actually is in the flesh, it's a young woman. Crazy young woman.
The actress, we couldn't figure out how to say her name. The actress who played Idris, the doctor's wife.
Saran.
Or the TARDIS, or whatever you want to call her. Yeah, well, yeah, it was Saran Wrap Jones. It was some kind of hybrid of Sarah Ann, but there probably was a Sarah Ann Jones registered to some actor's thing or something, I don't know, and she's Saran. We were calling her Sarani. That was fun. I kind of like that one the best. And let's see, what else? What else is really cool about this episode? I liked the auntie and uncle and nephew, the poor little Ood. And then, of course, then they capture Rory and Amy.
But you had the feeling that the Ood was only stuck in there because they had an Ood costume. And they didn't want to have to come up with a new alien and make a new alien costume. So let's just get out the Ood thing and put it on him.
Yeah.
I like that.
The BBC is so cheap. And
well, they are, you know, a public broadcasting, so they kind of have to be.
That's something to hold off for, though.
That's why they film in Cardiff, Mom.
Well, that's something you kind of have to hold off on, because that's also a complaint I had about the God Complex, which is, except for the main alien, the only ones he ever saw were photo stills on the walls. That's how cheap they were.
Yes.
Even cheaper than this.
Yeah, well, that was towards the end of the season or the series, so their budget was probably pretty thin at that point.
Yes.
They were wanting to blow it all on the finale. So we kind of it feels like we learn a lot of things. They lose the swimming pool in this episode in Squash Court 7, which was kind of funny.
But the Time Lords are supposed to be incredibly intelligent, and you wonder how auntie and uncle and nephew were so able to lure them and then use them the way they did.
Yeah.
It just, it's like, is the doctor the only smart one? Of course, he got lured there, but that's because he was desperately looking for any of his people.
Right, and it's another, like, writer's battle with Doctor Who, where you kind of, there's a part where, when you're a writer, you often kind of slip out of the story and go, okay, wait a minute, I'm seeing, I can physically see the writer trying to figure out how to type his way out of this wet paper bag that he just found himself
yeah.
stuck in. So, it's like, I've gotten the Doctor into this horrible, horrible thing. And of course he's going to get out of it, because we need our Scooby-Doo ending, but how are we going to do it? How clever am I? And then you kind of, and Moffat does that a lot. Like, Pandorica was really heavy like that.
Moffat, I do have some problems with Moffat. I think Moffat, rather than writing well sometimes, he's so intent upon showing that he's the brightest boy in the room. I'm the cleverest. I'm the best. And if I don't want that. I want good writing. I don't want this clever, timey-wimey, sciency-wyancy crap. I want good writing. And sometimes he just gets away from that. He gets all caught up in the...
Here's some placeholder text. We're going to put timey-wimey here, but we're going to come up with something better later. And then, you know, we never came up with anything better. Let's just go timey-wimey. I mean, that was... I think
yes.
that was Russell T. Davies. That was from Blank of All. Well,
yes.
that was Stephen Moffat, so it was Blank.
Yes, that was Stephen Moffat.
Of course
exactly.
it was. It always goes right back to Moffat.
Always goes back to Moffat.
Dermot Moffat.
Moffat, he's a good writer.
He is.
And he doesn't have to rely on this stuff,
mm-hmm.
but he keeps falling back on it all the time. And it just... He didn't do it quite so much in Blink. And Blink was a really good episode.
And he gets a lot of fairly positive reviews. There aren't a lot of naysayers, except I should get the article that Stephen Peacock did this article that's about, like, for and against Moffat, like, the good stuff he does
mm-hmm.
and then the problems. And it's really kind of neat. And he's where I agree with him. He's... You know, he has puzzle box storytelling and
yeah.
he has a lot of other things that he falls into. And sometimes when, my biggest complaint of Russell T. Davies is when you can sort of see the puppet strings of the characters, especially in Torchwood, you could like see the, you could physically like see the author sitting there typing and making the characters do things.
Well, that was Russell T.
That was Russell T.
Yeah.
With Moffat, you don't really see that as much, so much as... the how clever am I thing
yes.
falling into play.
Yes.
So that's like the, it's kind of the same problem, but it wears different hats. I don't know, Ryan, what do you think?
This actually has some interesting problems to it. There's certain amounts of things they cannot seem to get away with the status quo, which is that the Doctor always has to be, that's why I said they could have rebooted Gallifrey. They could have. Amy rewrote the universe from her own mind. She knew the Doctor was sad about his own people going. She could have easily at that, well, maybe not easily, but she had the entire universe in her head. She brought
right.
back people who had been erased by the crack, like her fiancé. She didn't bring that back because he still has to be the lonely hermit. He still has to have moments where he goes, I'm the last of my kind. That's one thing that they've never gotten away from with Russell T. Davies. But they still want it because they need that level of drama to milk, apparently. They're still clinging to it. Like their mother's teat.
Do you think...
No, there you go. Good line. But, no, my point is, in this one, he finds out that there were definitely Time Lords that survived.
Right.
The Time War. In a pocket dimension where he couldn't sense them anyway. No one ever says, oh, don't worry, Doctor, there could be another little pocket dimension somewhere. No one ever says that at all. It's just, oh, I had my hopes raised, and now I'm still the last of my kind. Woe is me. Woe is the burden on the Time Lord's shoulders. But that was it, and it... You also had a problem, and I wonder if this is from the rewrites. I can imagine Neil Gaiman wanting to make a fairy tale out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also imagine, and you know, that doesn't really have an explanation. Where did this thing come from? Why does it subsist on Time Lords? When did this cycle start? When did it first get its taste of its first Time Lord
right.
and its first time machine? Was it engineered for the Time War? They didn't touch that. I can almost imagine that it's, you know, luring Time Lords to their death, but they never really got there, so I don't know.
Well, when you were stating about the little pocket dimensions and all this, that's one of the things that Moffat does, is he throws these little things into this story here and that story there, And there are these little things that you have to pick up on and say, and then later on you find out where they fit in, mm-hmm. but at the time you don't know what to pick up on and what's important. But he wants you just to sit there rapt, going over everything he's done and trying to pick out all these little gems.
Yeah. Well, there's a moment, I think it's in, it's either in the second or third episode, I think it might be in the second episode, where Rory and Amy are kind of standing aside and trying not to let the doctor know that you know, you're going to die and here's why you're going to die. And they're mm-hmm. just talking amongst themselves and he's like, I'm being very clever and no one's here to see it. And that's very Moffat.
Yes.
I'm being clever and no one's here to see it and I don't like that.
Look at me.
Yeah. And so that really comes across, like, when you can, what?
Is that on or off?
It's on. The mic's on. It's okay.
It's okay.
If you heard some sounds other than the clock chiming, it was the fire being poked. Which it didn't.
Well, poke the dog now.
Poke the dog with the fire poker. I was just reading on Wikipedia. I was curious about the title of the episode, and it was originally titled The House of Nothing, and then they changed it to Bigger on the Inside, which always sounds kind of dirty to me. I've heard too many nerd jokes about Doctor Who, and they thought that it would give away the surprise that Idris was the TARDIS, so they changed it.
You mean it's a reference?
It's a reference. It's not specifically referenced in the referred to in the story. It's a reference to a fake title attached to a 1980s serial. And then I just get bored with reading the rest of that, and I too long didn't read.
I don't know. Some parts of it I didn't like the episode because, like I said, it as a villain, as a monster. Besides the fact that it had an ability to mess with TARDISes the way it did, it wasn't really that threatening.
Yeah.
Especially since it went up against the supposed most superior intelligent being, Time Lords. I mean,
yeah, the Time Lords are supposed to be so smart. Yeah. How come no one defeated it?
Except the Doctor. Yeah. Imagine if the Master had gotten involved in this. This thing was not in his league. Even the Rani, if she'd survived, would have really messed this thing up.
God, Wikipedia ruins everything, I swear. Gaiman was forced to operate with less money, blah, 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 and instead of being able to use a monster of his own design, he had to use a pre-existing Ood prop. Ah, you were right.
Yes.
You know, the beauty about Wikipedia is you can just delete that and then, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But to me, it was so obvious.
According to Wikipedia, on this date and time, it says this.
To me, it was so obvious
that it was just the costume laying around. Wikipedia right now?
Yes, I did. I just put that right in.
Now that's timey wimey.
You have no idea how to do Wikipedia.
No.
No. Whatever they call a Wikipedia editor. Of course, Idris immediately, all the cosplayers are like, this dress is gorgeous. I want to be Idris.
Yes.
I want to have just a mess of hair and this gorgeous dress. And the dress is really pretty. Like, I'm not sure that the one they had on display at, I'm hoping the one they had on display at the Doctor Who Experience was the dress, because they had a lot of costumes there, and I'm hoping it was all theirs and not knockoffs or something. I just am a little bit like, oh, I wonder if that's real or not. But it was really, really pretty.
Well, when Idris was in her manic phases, she made me think so much of David Tennant when he would go off on his.
Kind of. here's your direction. Act like David Tennant.
Yes. I think that's what they told her to do.
Act like number 10. I like it. It was definitely, I definitely got the feel this is something Neil Gaiman wrote. Throughout the whole thing, I'm like, this is something Neil Gaiman wrote. This is awesome. This is something Neil Gaiman wrote that was edited to crap, but bits of it were edited because Gaiman's a much more of a long form storyteller than.
Well, I know it's one of the more popular stories from the sixth season. So,
and it was good for ratings getting, and I think with the Doctor's Wife calling it that, they got their little, you know, juices flowing. What can we title stuff? We'll have a really good title for when we come back from mid season break, and we'll really get in the viewers. We'll talk about that one in a little bit. I think we'll stop this one right now. We may revisit some themes from The Doctor's Wife, but we'll stop this one now and move on to the next set of episodes. So, join us again for the next three episodes of Series 6 Doctor Who.